It's Jobs Day Friday, so there's that. Also, there was a little news item this week about the planetary economy from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal, the 2nd of June. Glad as always to have you along, everybody. The relevant numbers for the American economy on this Friday are 138,000 and 4.3. The latter is the unemployment rate, a 16-year low, by the by. The former is the number of jobs the economy added in May. Not really a great number, but it is where we're going to start today. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Anna Swanson is at the Washington Post. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Anna, give me your gut check on this jobs number. I mean, 4.3 is a nice rate, however, comma.
That's right. So the unemployment rate did fall to the lowest it's been in more than 16 years, but economists were quick to say that it fell for the wrong reasons, which are the participation rate also went down, so you had fewer people in the labor force. So overall, it was a pretty disappointing report. It was a low jobs number. You had that declining participation, and then wage growth was still a bit sluggish.
Sudeep, talk to me for a second about this 4.3% rate and inflation. We're going to play a little game of what is Janet Yellen thinking here in about 2.5 minutes. But with this economy basically at full employment, the worry here now is that inflation is going to rise, right? Help me understand that.
We have heard this before, haven't we?
That yes,
when
we
the economy gets closer to full employment, wage growth will pick up and the Fed will have to respond with tightening that could slow down the business cycle. We've been talking about it for so long. It hasn't happened, but we still think it's going to happen. So hope springs eternal. That's like that. It's okay. This is we have long expected overall job growth to slow as we got closer to full employment, but we have yet to see the effects of that we'd really want to see of a substantial improvement in the labor force participation rate of people coming off the sidelines at a greater pace and an increase in wage growth that suggests that the gains are being spread more broadly. That was the problem we've been facing all along and the problem we're still facing now.
All right. So very quickly, and Anna, you're going to get a pass this time because we've not done this with you before. But Sudeep, what is Janet Yellen thinking? Five words or less with the acknowledgement that the Fed meets in June to talk about interest rates. Go.
Not on my watch. That's what really wants to make sure that she moves cautiously. She moves slowly. That it's not going to all fall apart when she is in charge behind the wheel.
All right, fair enough.
I could do it if it's
go ahead. All right, show off. Go ahead.
What about one more hike, then wait and see? I think the Fed will still definitely make a move in June because the markets are expecting that. And
did Sudeep tell you this was coming? You were ready with it. Weren't
you? And the Fed doesn't like to disappoint the markets,
right?
Yeah,
no, absolutely
true. That's very important.
Absolutely true. All right, Anna, let me turn to the president's decision yesterday to pull the United States out of the Paris Climate Accords. I want to talk about this idea of businesses as a counterpoint to government action, because we are seeing now states, you know, California and New York, but also some of the most valuable companies on the planet, right? Google and Microsoft and Apple all saying we are going ahead with our global warming fighting policies. It's interesting now that companies are having to sort of be a check and balance on what the government does.
Definitely. Yeah, we saw, I think, at least 30 states and scores of companies coming out and saying that they were going to try to, you know, forge ahead with their own plans to combat climate change. And I mean, I think for companies, you know, it is a complication, though, because an economist was telling me this morning that, you know, while companies do like deregulation, what they really like is stable regulation. Hmm. They want to know what the policy environment will be like in a decade when some of the investments they're making now are coming to fruition. And I think that, you know, pulling out of this accord and then the prospect of a future administration going back in mm-hmm. creates some uncertainty for them.
Yeah, with the note that the earliest sort of possible action date on actually getting out of this thing is after the 2020 election. So there's some play there. Sudeep, let me get you back to this idea of American companies in a global economy. H.R. McMaster and Gary Cohn, two of the president's senior advisors, had that piece in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago in which they said this, talking about the president's trip. The president embarked on his first foreign trip with a clear-eyed outlook that the world is not a global community, but an arena where nations, non-governmental actors, and businesses engage and compete for advantage. It's interesting that They know that businesses compete on that global arena, and yet they seem to be pulling us out of it.
They are speaking to certain groups with it, with all this messaging. Each week we're treated to what seems like a new round of corporate rhetoric, and I guess it's a new lesson each week about the risk of oversimplification about what all these needs are. A small domestic energy company would not necessarily like the Paris Agreement and has different needs from a large international energy company, whether it's a coal or oil, that relies a lot on technology. A tech giant like Apple or Google has very different needs than a small manufacturer. And when you group them all together and say, this is what corporate America wants, you're obviously missing part of it. And that's the overall problem with a lot of the debate we have here, because we group everyone together instead of actually having a more nuanced policy across the board.
Sudeep Reddy at Politico, Anna Swanson at The Washington Post. Have a nice weekend, you too, huh?
You too. Thanks,
Thanks, Pat. You
all
too.
Right, take it easy. On Wall Street today, record highs all over the place. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So we were talking, Sudeep and Anna and I, about American businesses, no matter what President Trump says, still having to compete in a global economy. That is, the economy that exists inside a changing climate. And as we've been reporting all week, corporate America is already dealing with a low-carbon future. Case in point right now, Detroit. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
The U.S. auto industry is trying to sell cars in every corner of the globe. Michelle Krebs is an analyst with Auto Trader. Just look at China, she says.
It's a huge market for General Motors. Ford just recently got into the Chinese market and is growing its business there.
China's the largest car market in the world. They also have a big pollution problem they're interested in fixing quickly. Sam Abu El-Samad is an analyst for Navigant Research. He says the car industry is going to proceed as if the Paris Agreement is still in place.
They basically need to ignore these short-term fluctuations and deal with the scenarios that they know they're going to have to address in other markets.
On top of that, Abu El-Samad says the Paris Accord isn't even a legally binding agreement.
All the targets in there were voluntary anyway, which is what makes this whole thing more of a political show than anything actually quantitative.
While carmakers support the Paris Agreement, Brett Smith with the Center for Automotive Research points out they largely oppose tougher fuel economy standards set by the Obama administration.
So there's this two trains kind of running in opposite directions here, and the car companies have to be on both trains.
Smith says fuel-efficient cars aren't selling in the U.S. right now, but at least 10 states, including California, are keeping the stricter emissions targets.
California is a very important market, and as it starts to combine with some of the other states that will very likely continue this push, it becomes an even bigger market.
Smith says carmakers want a single regulatory structure, but in the short term, they may be selling trucks and SUVs in the U.S. and fuel-efficient models abroad. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Some of the big Wall Street banks, JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Citigroup, to name just three, are warning that their trading revenue in the second quarter is going to be down compared to a year ago. Goldman Sachs, pretty much the same thing. Seems all the market calm in the face of all the political volatility just isn't great for the trading business, as Marketplace's Annie Baxter explains.
The biggest banks get a decent chunk of revenue from facilitating stock and bond trades for investors in what's called market making.
It's when clients want to buy or sell, when they want to hedge, the banks are making money on that.
Jim Sinegal is an equity analyst with Morningstar. He says volatility drives up trading revenue. Investors make more buy and sell decisions when there's a lot going on. He says last year around this time, there was excitement about interest rates starting to rise. And then, of course, the volatile event par excellence, Britain's vote to leave the European Union last June.
Now there's not really any big stories in the quarter, and I think some of the optimism around the election, around movements in interest rates, that's faded a bit. So a pretty lackluster quarter as far as that goes.
Lackluster quarter? Shouldn't volatility on the domestic political stage be goosing banks' trading revenue? David Hilder, director in capital markets at Drexel Hamilton, offers this context.
Remember, these are global banks. Donald Trump may feel like a much bigger storm here in the United States than the lead up to the Brexit vote was in the UK and Europe. But let us not forget that the Brexit vote was a very big deal.
And to the extent that there is uncertainty in the U.S., it's the kind that makes investors sit on their hands and not want to make trades, according to Devin Ryan, managing director at JMP Securities.
They're looking for more direction out of D.C., big topics like tax reform and regulatory reform.
Seeking more direction? Investors aren't the only ones. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
It seems a long time ago now, but opioid abuse was a huge issue back during the presidential campaign. And for the communities across the country that are dealing with addiction, it still is. Erie, Pennsylvania is one of those communities where addicts who typically cycle in and out of prison are costing the county nearly $20 million a year. Erie is, as you know, the focus of our series, The Big Promise, how Donald Trump's campaign promises are playing out in places that voted for him. So Marketplace's Erica Barris has our story.
51 Bryant,
10-4-7-5-5-7,
please.
Heidi Karash has been working as a nurse in Erie for nearly 13 years. And to her, opioid addiction isn't just a crisis. It's a weight to bear.
It's been epidemic here in Erie.
And Karash worries she played a role in that. In her first job at Erie's Hammett Hospital, she says she treated patients who had OD'd on painkillers. She also gave those very same opioids to people in pain.
In the hospital, especially in the ICU, you know, we almost were more part of the problem than part of the solution.
And the problem has gotten worse. In the past decade, overdoses have nearly tripled in Erie. Every week, two people lose their lives to drugs. More than half of all inmates in Erie County Prison come in addicted. Heidi Karash became head of nursing here about 2 years ago.
Here, I can be part of the solution.
That solution includes Vivitrol, a drug designed to break what has become a destructive cycle. Addicts get arrested, detox in prison, get released, use again, and end up back where they started. Or they end up dead.
And I feel like I could have helped them, and it almost feels like a failure on my part.
Vivitrol is a monthly shot that acts like an opioid vaccine. The prison recently started giving opioid abusers the drug as they're released.
You get a shot. You're then kind of, there's kind of a force field around the part of your brain that likes heroin.
That's Joshua Lee, an addiction specialist at New York University. He says Vivitrol makes it impossible to feel high. The hope is the drug, which is being used in other prisons across the country, will curb addiction in Erie.
They work really, really, really well. We wish we had medications like this for hypertension or diabetes or depression, but we don't.
But Vivitrol is a lot like other drugs when it comes to aggressive marketing and sky-high prices. Prisons and inmates get the first dose of the drug for free. As they're being released, then they're on their own. And insurers may prefer to pay for the drug in pill form rather than the $1,000 monthly shot. As Christina Paul found out, that can be an important difference.
That's making a choice every day to not get high today.
Paul, a former heroin addict, lives in Erie with her two daughters. Her boyfriend got clean with the help of Vivitrol, got a job, and got off Medicaid. His new insurance, though, didn't cover the shot, just the daily pills.
He did okay at first with it, but then just kind of, he didn't want to take a daily pill, so.
Within a couple months, he was using again. Not long after, he was dead. It's unclear how drug treatment programs that were guaranteed under the Affordable Care Act will fare under new healthcare legislation. But at this point, they are slated to be cut back severely, despite campaign promises by Donald Trump. At the Erie County Prison, Heidi Karash says the loss of those services will only add to Erie's already considerable pain.
I think that in Erie, a lot of people have lost hope. And I think that this last election was a sign of that.
Karash, who spent her life in this town, has also seen family and friends struggle with addiction. She says Erie's economy and the lack of good jobs are a big part of the problem.
It's not like you have to stay clean to go to work the next day. So you just start using to kind of cope with the sadness. And that's maybe why the first reason you shot up, but then you become addicted.
Vivitrol can't fix those problems, but it can keep people from using. And Karash says at this point, that's something. In Erie, I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Every single pocket is reinforced. There's double stitching everywhere.
Because aprons that can't take the heat have to get out of the, well, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 62 points today, more than a quarter percent, finished at 21,206. NASDAQ up 58 points, 0.9%, 6305. S&P 500 up 9 points, 0.3%, 2439. Records all for the week. The Dow up 0.5%, NASDAQ up 1.5%, the S&P 500 bumped up 0.9% today. The House is set to take up Dodd-Frank banking rules next week, as in loosening them. So, banking stocks fell. Go figure that out. Capitalism. Bank of America down 0.7%. J.P. Morgan Chase dipped about 0.5%. Goldman Sachs down 0.7% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.15%. We were talking about, what is Janet Yellen thinking? Here's what she's thinking. 2.15%? What? You're listening to Marketplace. Hi, everybody. It's Kai Rizdahl. Marketplace is here because these days it's essential to have an independent source explaining how the economy really works, not just for CEOs, but for everybody. Your support keeps this kind of reporting coming, and it's especially vital now at the end of our fiscal year. So please visit marketplace.org/donate to contribute and to keep us in your world every day. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The meal kit delivery company Blue Apron has filed to go public. Investors hoping to get a piece of it at the IPO or later are going to be buying into a company that's got a young customer base and that is growing super fast, but also one with a business model that is not all that complicated, shall we say. So what really are investors getting for their money with a company like that? Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
First thing about initial public offerings, Joe Public doesn't get much of a look in.
Most of the people that buy in immediately at the time of the IPO are going to be big institutional investors.
Like mutual funds and big banks, says Michelle Lowry, professor of finance at Drexel University. Underwriters of the stock offer it first to their most favored clients before the public are given a chance.
There's a lot of quid pro quo in this. You give me some business and I give you some business back.
That's one return. Here's another. IPOs have an average one-day return of 15%. What's not to love? The risk. Josh Lerner, an investment banking professor at Harvard University, says investors try to minimize that by doing their homework.
These investors often will have analysts who will really look at these IPOs. They'll go to the road shows. They'll interview the management and say, are these guys contenders or pretenders?
Energetic young companies with impressive growth like Blue Apron can seem like a good bet, but many have to spend heavily on marketing to win name recognition. Matt Kennedy is with investment company Renaissance Capital. He says one big question is whether those companies can successfully scale up and retain customers.
If they can hang on to those customers, that can be a high-margin business that investors are interested in getting into.
But big, savvy investors like Vanguard and Fidelity may be wary if they see a company's business model can be easily copied. For every potential Amazon out there, there are also dogs like Pets.com that generated lots of excitement but went belly up. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
I had something happen the other day that hasn't happened in all the time I've been doing this job. We were down in Vernon. It's about 15 minutes or so from Marketplace Central here in downtown LA. It's kind of industrial, lots of warehouses and factories, but there is at least one building that's a little different on the inside. Tree houses, the prefab kind you find in backyards instead of cubicles. A community space with a kitchen and picnic tables and an espresso machine. It's the headquarters of a company called Headley and Bennett. They make aprons, really nice, good aprons. Designer chef wear, I suppose you could say, a favorite supplier of Martha Stewart and Alton Brown, to drop just a couple of names. Anyway, we walk in, I'm looking around, and then it happened. Helen,
hi.
Kai, how are you?
So we all nice
get
to,
hugs.
Yes,
we get hugs.
Everybody gets hugs here.
This is a hugs place.
Yes,
okay.
This is hugs and
good.
Ice cream.
Excellent.
All around.
Well, thanks for taking the time.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited.
That
to have
was
it.
Ellen Bennett, founder, CEO, and chief visionary.
Well, I've always wanted to be like the Nike of the culinary world. Basically,
that's a big, hairy goal.
It's so hairy. I really, really wanted to basically like outfit people and give them a sense of dignity and pride in the kitchen, which didn't exist. I was a line cook myself.
I was gonna say, we should say, you know whatever you speak, right?
Yes. I was a line cook at Providence and Baco Mercat here in LA. Yeah. And we, you know, would get our buns handed to us every night and working seriously long hours and, you know, trying to become a chef, right?
Yeah.
And gosh, if only I could make a uniform that I could wear and put on and have some dignity and pride and hold my head up higher when I cook for myself and my team.
Is it true that you started while you were still cooking?
Yes, I was very much still a cook. My chef at Baco came up to me and he's like, hey, there's a girl. She's going to make us some aprons. Do you want to get in on that order? And I was like, chef, I have an apron company now. I will make you those aprons. And I totally had nothing. I clocked out and I ran around town trying to find
and
fabrics.
Were you like sewing them yourself and the whole deal?
No, I don't know how to sew. I don't know how to sew.
That somehow is great. That somehow is great.
Yeah. I bartered with people. Yeah. So I was working at two great restaurants, right? So I was like, I'll come and make you dinner if you make me a pattern. I'll come make you breakfast if you make me the apron cut. And that was how I sort of got the first one off the ground.
And you're doing well. I mean, seven figures is what I saw. Right?
Yeah, we're in over 4,000 restaurants in the U.S. now.
That's a lot.
Yeah, and this year we're launching in Williams-Sonoma and Sur La Table nationwide.
Oh man! So
and
now
we're
you're like
Whole
made,
Foods,
right?
Too.
I mean,
yeah.
Right?
So we work our butts off. Let's to say that lightly.
When did you go? This is so interesting. When did you go from line cook to entrepreneur?
I think I was sort of born that way. I don't think I became an entrepreneur because of Hedley and Bennett. I think you have it in you and you have that drive and hustle and it's just sort of a piece of you. But that moment when I told my chef that I would make him those aprons, I think that that was a very strong marking point in my life as a, I don't know, hooligan / entrepreneur.
You have some I got to see.
Yes, let's go.
Let's go. All right, come on.
I love that this is a walking...
Oh, no, totally. All you have to
over
do...
Here,
all you
wrong way.
Oh, sorry, sorry.
Hi. Watch out for the zip line. There's a zip line.
Of course there is.
So they're over here.
All right, so talk me through some of the elements of these things. Because you, I mean, there's like design elements and I guess functionality elements,
totally
right?
Totally functional. Right, so, like super mega functional.
So show me.
So some of the things that we have on our aprons are every single pocket is reinforced. There's double stitching everywhere.
Are pockets a big thing in kitchens?
Yes. And I'm like a bulldozer in the kitchen. So all my pockets would
shocked.
Rip off.
I can't believe that you go in there and you knock stuff over. Having met you 20 minutes ago.
And having hugged your sound
right.
guy
that's
in the first 2 minutes who was
thing.
Like, what's going on? What's happening?
If only
emergency.
You knew.
Yes. So every single pocket's reinforced bar tacks. We double stitch everything. We do this little thing at the bottom, which basically makes it so that the apron doesn't curl when you wash it.
Yeah. You are a manufacturing company here in Los Angeles too, right?
Yeah, we're a full-blown manufacturing company. And we do our shipping and distribution, everything. And people can come and visit. Like, this is totally open to the public. And it's awesome because nobody actually sees what manufacturing is like these days.
That's totally true. That's
right?
Totally
and
true.
So here you have little kids getting to see the process from start to finish of how you actually make something. This is not being done overseas in some big giant factory with 1,000 people. This is like people's livelihoods are right here in front of you. So over here.
And here it is.
Yeah. So we have cutting and sewing. And then we work with 4 other factories nearby that do our work shirts and chef coats. And each team is specialized and just does different stuff.
Here comes the boring business question then.
Tell me.
You are a small businesswoman in this economy. How
are
you feeling about things? Right?
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, that's how
questions.
I feel. Deep sighs, especially since I'm going for American made here. You know, that's challenging, especially in California. And we just gave our entire staff health care as of 3 weeks ago. So that was a big move and costly, but it's something that we really thought was very important. And so we figured it out. And just how we figured out how to get our first office and how to get our first order, we figured out how to get healthcare. And it was just, we made it happen.
Really impressive. I'm blown away.
Wait, you're not even done looking at the whole space. Let's go.
There's more?
Yes. So over here, sewing teams.
Saw that. We got pictures, too. It's a pretty cool space. Also, me in aprons. Check it out, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, getting us back up to the top of the program and the news of the week, the unemployment report today and the president's decision to bail on the Paris Climate Agreement yesterday. I saw this in The Economist. They went combing through some data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics to find the kinds of jobs in this economy with the fastest growth rates over the next 10 years. So with that as background, what do you think? What's the job? Anybody? Get this. Wind turbine service technician. Ironic, no? All right, Friday. Got to go. The Dow up 62 points today, more than a quarter percent. NASDAQ up 58, 0.9%. S&P 500 up 9, 0.3%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizal. Have a good weekend, everybody. We are back on Monday, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.